From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Over this extended holiday weekend, we're going back in the Fresh Air archives to bring you some interviews from the past. We begin with an interview with actor Eli Wallach on The Method, Tennessee Williams, Spaghetti Westerns, and Godfather 3. Then we go back to an interview with cartoonist Matt Groening, creator of The Simpsons, recorded on the eve of the series' debut. Also, we feature a 1988 interview with actor Bob Hoskins and some music by Jelly Roll Morton. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. In Hamburg, Germany today, 10,000 people attended a memorial service for a Turkish woman and two young girls who were murdered in a firebombing on Monday. The three were killed when suspected neo-Nazis threw firebombs into their apartment building in a town about 25 miles east of Hamburg. The mourners were largely Turkish immigrants, but they were accompanied by a large number of Germans, including the country's foreign minister and labor minister. Turks comprise Germany's largest foreign group with about 1.6 million people. Many younger people have grown up and been educated entirely in Germany. Spanish officials announced four arrests today in the killing of an immigrant from the Dominican Republic. The murderer is being called racially motivated. The alleged trigger man is a member of the Spanish security forces. Al Goodman reports from Madrid.
The arrest came 2 weeks after masked men burst into a makeshift home for immigrants in Madrid and opened fire. They killed a 33-year-old housemaid from the Dominican Republic. The murder caused an outrage in Spain, which wants to avoid the racism sweeping across Europe. There have been several demonstrations against racism since then. The largest march attracted thousands of people in Madrid. The prime suspect in the killing is a 25-year-old member of Spain's Civil Guard, a national police force that investigated the crime. Officials say he has been cited previously for violent actions and used his police pistol to fire the fatal shots. The three other suspects were listed as juveniles. Police say the assailants acted alone and are not part of any far-right hate groups. For National Public Radio, I'm Al Goodman in Madrid.
Near downtown Milwaukee today, a gasoline tanker truck fell from a freeway interchange, crashed, and burned. The driver was killed, and the spilled gasoline caused explosions. NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports.
The 5,000-gallon tanker skidded through a guardrail and fell 40 feet from one interstate highway onto another at a busy interchange west of downtown. The truck crashed and burned in a parking lot used by Milwaukee County government employees and crushed at least six cars, according to witnesses, but apparently no one there was hurt. Gasoline from the truck flowed into sewers, and area residents reported hearing at least two explosions, but most of the gas evaporated or burned in a fire that cast a black, smoky pall over parts of the city. Local police and firefighters closed the roads leading to the area of the accident, slowing traffic for hours after the fire was extinguished. Authorities are still trying to identify the truck driver, whose body was badly burned. I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
Stock prices closed higher today in a shortened session of pre-holiday trading on Wall Street. Analysts said investors were responding to this week's positive economic news, including today's report that personal income and consumer spending rose in October. The Dow Industrials gained nearly 16 points to close at 3,282. This is NPR. Senator Bob Packwood said today that he'll seek professional advice on his use of alcohol and that drinking may account for the allegations that he made unwanted sexual advances to 10 women. The Oregon Republican issued a statement saying that he'll find out if, in his words, there is a chemical dependency problem. The statement said that Packwood did not know if alcohol was a factor in the incidents of alleged sexual harassment, but said that alcohol can only be a partial explanation, not an excuse. The U.S. joined Britain and France today in a new round of denunciations of Libya. The three countries have been demanding for a year that Libya turn over security officials that the West says are responsible for the bombings of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland. Alan Dowd of Maine Public Radio reports from Kennebunkport, where President Bush is spending the holiday.
we...
The written statement released by White House spokesman Marwin Fitzwater says Libya is evading the demands of the United Nations. It accuses Libya of flouting international law by ignoring UN resolutions that demand Libya cease any support for international terrorism. The White House statement evoked the memory of Pan Am Flight 103, saying justice for the victims demands that Libya comply with the UN. The statement offers little in the way of specifics on how Libya will be made to comply, but says the U.S., France, and Britain will work closely to make sure sanctions already imposed by the U.N. work. The White House says Libya's failure to comply will only lead to its further isolation from the world community. For National Public Radio, I'm Alan Dowd in Kennebunkport.
U.S. diplomats in Angola said today that the ceasefire between the government and rebel forces appears to be holding, but said there have been military buildups in some provinces. Joseph Scheiber, a spokesman for the U.S. liaison office in Luanda, told the Associated Press today that tensions are still high. He said communications in the country are so poor that some field commanders may not receive the ceasefire orders. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Over this Thanksgiving holiday weekend, we thought you might enjoy hearing an interview from the Fresh Air archives that we especially enjoyed with actor Eli Wallach. Eli Wallach is such a versatile actor. He's famous for his interpretation of Tennessee Williams and for his starring roles in Westerns. Williams gave Wallach one of his first big breaks, casting him in a production of The Rose Tattoo. Wallach made his film debut in Baby Doll, which was also written by Williams. In 1960, Wallach was the heavy in The Magnificent Seven. He later played another heavy in a film of heavies, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. His other movies include The Misfits, The Lineup, The Victors, Girlfriends, Movie Movie, and more recently, Godfather III and The Mistress. Wallach was a charter member of the Actors Studio, where the actors practiced a technique that became known as the method.
All of it basically was an antidote from the cliché, from the conventional. You know, when an actor says, "I remember," and he always looks up the sky, you think, what is he seeing up there? But that was a signal that he's remembering. And the method basically was to destroy all that and to get to the truth of a situation. So the studio was like a laboratory. We were professional actors in the theater, but we could go there and work out. I could go and do a scene from Hamlet with Millie Dunnick, for example. I'd do the closet scene. I wouldn't get to do that on Broadway, and I did it there.
Yet there were clichés about actors who'd studied the method at the Actors Studio, right? What was the cliché that you had to resist about actors from the Actors Studio?
Well, there's a myth that all members of the studio mumbled. All members of the studio paid no attention to the other person. They were so involved in dredging up the truth of what they had that they paid no attention to the other person. Those are myths. We were impossible. We discovered a new religion, and we had no patience for other actors. I never forget taking Sir Laurence Olivier to the Actors Studio, and he said, "Well, I can see you're nitpicking now, you know." And I said, "Well, you did it too. You have your way of working." Olivier, for example, gets into a character by putting on the externals. He puts on the nose and the robe and so on, and that's the way he gets it. Others say, which comes first? Do you find the truth of the situation? I've played all sorts of characters, bandits. I've played a lot of bandits. And one time I figured out, you always see them holding up the train or breaking into the bank. You never see what they do with the money. It's always the pursuit of it. I wanted to show the reverse side of the coin. I wanted to show the wealth this guy ostentatiously had. So I put on red silk shirts and gold teeth and silver saddles. And that's where the method helps, a kind of a technique that you work at to bring a character to life.
Was that The Magnificent Seven?
That was The Magnificent Seven, yeah.
My guess is Eli Wallach, since you've brought up how many bandits you've played, let me bring up a couple of films you've played them in. One was The Magnificent Seven, and you played the head of a band of Mexican outlaws,
right,
who raids a village and keeps this village under the outlaws' control. And the Magnificent Seven is a group of kind of renegade freelance fighters who save this Mexican village. How'd you get cast in that role? First of all, you were Mexican.
I don't really know. I know that when I first read the script, I said, Well, I want to play the crazy... It was based on the Seven Samurai.
Mm-hmm.
I want to play the crazy samurai. Oh, no, they said, that's the love interest. Horst Buchholz is going to play it. What do you want me to play? They said, the head bandit. I said, well, in the Japanese movie, you just see his horse's hoofs, and he's a man with an eye patch. I don't want to play that. Then I read the script carefully, and I come in right into town on the first minute of that movie, shoot somebody, and ride out. The next 50 minutes of that movie are devoted to me saying, is he coming back? When is he coming? I said, I'll do it. I'll do it. And I used to arrive on the set early in the morning, put on my outfit, get on my horse with my 35 bandits, and we'd go for an hour ride through the brush in Tepoztlan in Mexico. And I loved it. I loved it.
Did you have to learn gunplay and horse riding for the role?
No. If it says I shoot somebody, I shoot them. I'll never forget what my son said. Yul Brynner shot and killed me in this movie. And my son was about 7, and he said to me, gee, Dad, couldn't you outdraw Yul Brynner? I said, Peter, when you read the script, you read whether you're shot or not shot. So I love those kind of films. They're fun.
Now, another famous Western that you did is The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Right.
Now, this is the most celebrated of the spaghetti Westerns.
Correct.
And the director, Sergio Leone, is now considered one of the great directors of our time. He was not known, though, when you worked with him on The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Did you think of him as a great or potentially great director then?
No, when I was making a film in California, when the agent out there said, there's an Italian here who wants you to be in a movie. I said, what kind of movie? He said, a Western. He said, a spaghetti Western. I said, that's an anomaly. That's like Hawaiian pizza. I don't know. He said, he wants you to look at a few minutes of one of his other movies. And I looked at a few minutes and I said, I'll do it. Where do you want me to go? He said, I want you in Rome on such and such a date. And I arrived. And I spent the next 4.5 months working every day on that movie. And it was an exhilarating experience.
Now, what had he seen of yours?
Evidently, The Magnificent Seven. So that, I don't know how, you never know how things happen in the movies.
Did it seem ironic to you that you and Clint Eastwood, who had played in American Westerns, were now making a Western for an Italian director?
Originally, all those Italians changed their names. Two of the biggest stars in Italy are Terence Hill and Bud Spencer. Their real names are Mario Girotti and Carlo Pedersoli. And they changed their names because no one wanted to go and see Italians playing Westerns. But I, after The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, I spent about 6 years off and on in Italy doing Westerns.
You played a Mexican in The Good, Bad, and the Ugly.
Yep.
So once again, you had to do a Mexican accent. But it was a light one. It was kind of light,
yes.
Mexican accent. I want to play a short clip from the movie.
Oh.
Okay. And this is a scene. If anyone remembers the story, I'm sure a lot of our listeners do, you and Clint Eastwood have this scam going. There's a big price on your head.
Right.
So Clint Eastwood brings you into the law. And just as they're about to hang you, he cuts you loose and you both ride away and you split the bounty.
Exactly.
So you split the price that was on your head. So this is after the first time when you're about to be hung, Clint Eastwood frees you and you're splitting up the bounty.
Right.
There are two kinds of people in the world, my friend. Those with a rope around their neck and the people who have the job of doing the cutting. Listen, the neck at the end of the rope is mine. I run the risks. So the next time I want more than half.
You may run the risks, my friend, but I do the cutting. We cut down my percentage. Cigar? Liable to interfere with my aim.
But if you miss, you had better miss very well. Whoever double-crosses me and leaves me alive, he understands nothing about Tuco. Nothing.
I love that little sadistic laugh at the end.
But I don't think it's a very good Mexican accent. It's standardized. It isn't. I didn't do the cliche of I thin, maybe I do la thad. You know, I didn't do that. I wanted specifically to be clear in what I was saying.
So where did you get the accent from?
I went to school in Texas as a young man. I went to the University of Texas in the 30s. In my class were John Connolly, Walter Cronkite, Zachary Scott, and Elaine Steinbeck. And I used to ride horses down there, and I used to go to Mexico as often as I could. I loved Mexico. I think Mexico is a pure country. It's a good country. And so I picked up. Accents always frighten me, but I once played an Oriental on the stage in London, Tea House of the August Moon, and I was convinced that at some point in the play, some Japanese man would stand up in the audience and point at me and say, "Faker, that man is not an Oriental." See? And I get terrified that I'd get discovered.
In the Italian westerns that you made, especially in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, everything's dubbed, right?
Right.
Afterwards?
Right.
So what language did you do it in initially?
Oh, I do it in English.
You do it in English.
But I've played with Italians, French, German. They play in their language. I play in mine.
So in these international casts, everybody's talking in their own language,
exactly.
And it's dubbed in afterwards.
It's the Tower of Babel. It really is. But you wait until they stop speaking, or you know what the sense of what they're saying. But then you have to go in a studio and dub it. And I kept thinking of scenes on horseback riding through the desert. Now I am in a studio. I have to match the essence of what he's saying. It's not easy.
Why do they do it that way?
Because it's easier and cheaper. An airplane flies over, they don't stop a scene. They drop a wrench in the middle of a scene. It makes a noise, they don't care. Two other Italians over in a corner will be arguing about something. One director said to an Italian actor who's playing with me, he said to me, the Italian actor said, "I don't like Americans." I said, "Why?" He said, "I lost my arm in the war." I said, "Well, I don't know. What could I do?" He was not an actor. So the director said, "I want you to count from 1 to 10 angrily." So the man said, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And then when they dub it in, he's playing a wonderful scene, an angry actor. Well, that's movies.
The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly is really one of the most kind of brutal, sadistic westerns.
No, it's done with tongue-in-cheek.
I know. It is. I know there's a lot of humor in it. But what kind of mood did Leone, I'm never sure which it is, tell you that he wanted?
One of the things he said to me, he said, "I want every shot to be done like Vermeer. I want the light to come in from the side windows." And he said to me, "I don't want you to have your gun in a holster." I said, "Where will I put it?" He said, "With a lanyard around your neck." I said, "Oh, and then it dangles between my knees, right?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "When you want it, you twist your shoulders, and I cut, and the gun is in your hand." I said, "Show me." He put it around his neck. He twisted his shoulder. He missed the gun. It hit him in the groin. He said, "Keep it in your pocket." So that's
It's interesting that you became a kind of action hero when you were probably in your 50s already.
When The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly?
And The Magnificent Seven.
Yeah.
You must have been in your 40s in The Magnificent Seven. But, you know, like today, most action heroes are a lot younger. It's like they start off in their 20s and 30s playing that kind of role. Yeah. Did you feel like it was an odd match?
Well, you wear very tight pants in these movies, and to get up on a horse, they'd always have to cut. I'd put my foot in the stirrup, but then they'd cut away to somebody looking at me, and the next thing I was on the horse. See? So, no, I tell you, in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, I did most of the stunts, and they were very dangerous. I was sitting on a horse with a noose around my neck, and Clint's supposed to shoot the rope, then they put a little charge of dynamite in the rope, and it would explode. And then I would ride off on this horse. I said, "Did you put any cotton in the horse's ears?" They said, "What do you mean, cotton in the horse's ears?" I said, "He can hear the explosion. He's going to be terrified. My hands are tied behind me." Well, they didn't do it. They shot the rope, and that horse took off. Now I'm riding, not using reins, just using my knees, and praying that that horse would eventually stop. And eventually he did. But it was frightening.
Oh, I'm really impressed because, I mean, that horse really takes off
Oh, yeah.
after the gun goes off.
Oh, yeah.
And I assumed there was some kind of trick there or something, because I figured it would really need a stunt rider to ride like that with their hands tied behind their back.
No, I rode, but you have to be very careful. Horses are not, you know, I just came from Lexington, Kentucky, in the horse country. We did the play down there. And horses are not supposed to be too smart. Thoroughbreds are very frisky. They're angry most of the time.
Yeah.
The horses I get in America, in American films, are trained. They know how to hit their marks. They shift their weight. They look great. But when you get into a foreign movie and they bring out a horse, I say, I want the gentlest, sweetest horse. And he usually turns around and looks at me when I sit on him and thinks, oh, God, I've got this guy for 3 weeks. But I like riding.
My guest is actor Eli Wallach. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring an interview from the archives with actor Eli Wallach, recorded in 1990.
I want to get back to something you were saying before. You were describing how you learned how to ride a horse and how you learned a Mexican accent when you were at the University of Texas. I can't think of a lot of people from Brooklyn who went to Texas to go to college, and this must have been, what, the 1940s?
In the 30s.
In the 30s. What got you to Texas to go to college?
The tuition was $30 a year. The University of Texas was an oil-rich college, university. It's a huge plant now with 40, 50,000 students. When I went, it was 4,000 students. And I couldn't get into City College. I didn't have the grades. I never liked high school. And I finally wound up down in Texas. I'll never forget, after the first semester, I went back up to New York to make some money for my tuition. And I wore a big belt that said Texas on it. And they used to call me Tex. Here I was from Brooklyn. And so they assigned me as a horseback riding counselor. And so I had to ride. And that's one of the reasons I rode a lot.
When did you start acting?
As a boy, as a little boy. Then before the war, I went into the neighborhood playhouse. I failed the teacher's exam. Everybody in my family were teachers. Thank God I failed it. And I went, got a scholarship to the neighborhood playhouse school of the theater. I'm on the board of that school now. It's a wonderful acting school. I finished, one of the teachers was Martha Graham, Sanford Meisner, and so on. I finished in 1940, and our senior project was a dance from Look Homeward Angel. Tony Randall was in the class. We choreographed Look Homeward Angel. And at one point, Uncle Sam stands on a thing and points a finger at me and says, Uncle Sam wants you. And sure enough, I got a low number in the draft, and Uncle Sam got me. So I went in the Army at the end of 1940 and got out at the end of 1945. So I spent 5 full years in the Army, not acting. I kept thinking, Broadway, here I come. And Uncle Sam kept saying, wait a minute, we've got problems here. So I spent 5 years as a medical administrator in the Army.
Eli Wallach is my guest. We'll be seeing you soon in Godfather 3. I haven't been keeping up with all the articles about it. What kind of role do you play in it?
I play a character called Don Altobello.
You're Italian again.
Yes, tall and handsome. Don Altobello, an old, old friend of the Corleone family. So I said to Coppola, the director, if I'm such an old, old friend of the family, why wasn't I in Godfather 1 and Godfather 2? He says, well, you were away in Sicily. And it was very sweet. The second day I was going to work on this movie, he said to me, you're going to play it all in Sicilian. I said, no, I don't know Sicilian. He said, well, get a guy, you get a cassette, you'll memorize it. So I memorized it, and there'll be subtitles under that scene, that specific scene. I play, it sounds like this. E che bello vita stare qua. Like that.
Had you seen The Godfathers 1 and 2?
Oh, yes.
So you felt you could just pick up on the story?
Well, no. When I got the script, the last 10 pages were omitted.
Why?
Because he didn't want anybody to know their fate in this movie.
Oh, like Woody Allen.
Oh, you had no idea where I was going. I didn't know what was going to happen to me. And it's very interesting not to know. It's like life. You don't know when you're going to pop off, right? And he was a fascinating director because he would stimulate. He'd tighten a screw here and tighten a screw there with just a word or two. And he'd leave me alone pretty much. I played an old man with an hour and 20 minutes of these rubberized makeup thing on. Now, to go from Cinecittà in Rome back to my hotel at the Spanish Steps would take an hour by car. So I rode the subway. So the first day I finished, I got on the subway, which was 20 minutes, very fast. And I'm sitting there looking at my script, and I'm peeling off all this rubberized makeup. And I look up, and there, the opposite side of the car of the subway, they're all staring at me. Half my chin was off with this rubberized. And I put it back on, and they applauded. That's Italy.
Did they realize you were an actor? Did they think something very grotesque was happening?
They knew I was coming from Cinecittà, so they know all the actors come out of that studio.
Oh, I see. I see. You're currently in Philadelphia performing in A.R. Gurney's play Love Letters, and you're performing with your wife, Ann Jackson. I know this is a play that you're very fond of. Tell us something about it.
Well, what's fascinating about this is every actor in America wants to do this play. And it's being done by a great number of actors. E.G. Marshall is doing it with Colleen Dewhurst. Matthew Broderick is doing it with some young actress. In England, it's being done by Robert Wagner and Stephanie Powers. It's being done all over the United States and all over the world. It's two people sitting there reading letters to one another from about age 6 to their late 50s. And an audience becomes hooked into this correspondence and what happens to these two people. And they all identify with it. They remember their first kiss, their first date, going dancing, your first affair. All of that is taken in, and it's just wonderful. It's wonderful to hear an audience respond to that.
You've, throughout your career, divided your time between theater and movies. Have you had a preference? What kind of balance have you wanted to keep?
Well, I've got the appetite still to act. I love to act. And I don't care where it is. It could be in a tiny theater in Chicago, or it can be on a huge stage in New York, or a movie in the middle of the jungle in Cambodia. The fact is that I'm acting in each one of those media, in the media. But if given a choice, if I were told by a judge, you can only practice one of television, movies, or the theater, I'd choose the theater without hesitation.
Why?
Because the gratification is immediate. There's a connection between me and an audience. I have control over what you see. In a movie, you only see what's put on the screen. I did that movie, The Two Jakes, with Jack Nicholson. When they cut it and edited it, I had a long scene in a courtroom that was cut out. Now no one knows about that. In The Good, the Bad, the Ugly, there's 20 minutes of me tracking down Clint Eastwood in a cave. It's beautiful, brilliantly shot. No one has ever seen it. So I don't like that. I like to have control over what you see.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
A pleasure.
Eli Wallach as recorded in 1990. More interviews from our archives in the second part of today's show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, more interviews from the Fresh Air Archives. When we talked with cartoonist Matt Groening, his animated family, The Simpsons, was just about to get its own TV series, and he wasn't sure how successful it would be. Yeah, well, the rest is history. Coming up, an interview with Matt Groening on the eve of his success with The Simpsons. Also, an interview with actor Bob Hoskins about what he learned from John Gielgud. And a song you didn't get to hear from our recent concert of music by Jelly Roll Morton. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. The Bush administration confirmed today that it's considering joint military activity with the United Nations to protect food shipments to Somalia. Earlier this week, the United States offered troops to help the UN. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
There is food in Somalia. The problem is that warring factions are stealing the food at gunpoint, even though some 300,000 people have died and millions are at risk. The UN has already authorized 3,500 troops, but only 500 are on the ground. President Bush is offering U.S. ground troops as a major part of a multinational force. White House Press Secretary Marlon Fitzwater said the worsening situation makes additional action necessary.
The relief supplies have become a pawn in the power struggles within the country. And it's just reached a point where it's no longer tenable.
A multinational UN force is by no means certain. A decision from the UN is expected next week. I'm Phyllis Crockett in Washington.
Oregon Senator Bob Packwood said today drinking may explain his alleged sexual harassment of 10 women, and the Republican senator said he'd seek professional help. In a statement today, Packwood said he wasn't sure if alcohol was a factor in the incidents, but he said at best it was only a partial explanation, not an excuse for his behavior. Packwood also said he'd cooperate with a possible Senate Ethics Committee investigation. President-elect Bill Clinton is in California this weekend to combine a little of the nation's economic business with a vacation on the beach. From Los Angeles, Kitty Feldy reports.
Mr. Clinton began his trip with a one-hour meeting with former President Ronald Reagan. The president-elect says Mr. Reagan offered advice on how to work with Congress and hold down federal spending, but also told him to take advantage of Camp David as a private retreat from the public eye. Despite their political differences, Mr. Clinton says the two agreed that Congress should pass the Brady Bill.
I thanked him for supporting the Brady Bill. We talked about the Brady Bill at some length, and he said that he felt very strongly that at least if we had a national waiting period, it would minimize the likelihood that mentally disturbed people would hurt and kill people.
Mr. Clinton is also doing some Christmas shopping at a local mall before he drives up the coast with wife Hillary, daughter Chelsea, and two of her girlfriends to a seaside retreat just south of Santa Barbara. For National Public Radio, this is Kitty Feldy in Los Angeles.
Soldiers behind today's failed coup attempt in Venezuela said they rebelled because President Carlos Andres Perez has not shared the country's wealth with the poor. Despite Venezuela's large oil reserves and strong economic growth this year, almost a quarter of its people live in extreme poverty. At least 19 people were killed in today's coup attempt. Stock prices closed higher today. The Dow Jones Industrials gained nearly 16 points. This is NPR. The Federal Centers for Disease Control released a report today saying blacks have a much higher rate of premature death than whites for most illnesses. The CDC says AIDS is one example. The virus now is the fourth leading cause of premature death among black men, along with cancer. Researchers say the AIDS death rate for black women is 9 times that of white women. The CDC also finds the gap between black and white premature death rates continues to widen. Irish voters have rejected a proposal to relax the country's ban on abortion. The government-sponsored amendment was opposed by both sides of the abortion issue. The BBC's Gary Duffy reports.
The main proposal to allow abortion where the life of the woman was at risk as distinct from her health is now well on its way to being substantially defeated. But it's clear that many of the electorate voted the same way for different reasons. Some backed pro-life campaigners and individual Catholic bishops who said abortion should be opposed at all costs. But those who support a woman's right to choose also rejected the measure because they want to build on the existing legal situation. They believe the referendum made an insulting distinction between the life and physical or mental health of the mother. Earlier this year, the Irish Supreme Court ruled that abortion should be allowed where there was a substantial risk to the woman's life, including the threat of suicide.
The BBC's Gary Duffy. The German government today banned a small neo-Nazi party and raided its locations in about 40 German cities. Officials called the moves a warning signal to the extreme right. They said investigations of other rightist groups will continue and called the recent attacks on foreigners shameful, harming Germany's international reputation. The organization targeted today is called the Nationalist Front. The government says the front's program is similar to Hitler's. Economists are predicting a strong holiday shopping season after today's government report that personal incomes rose a solid 1% in October. The increase is the biggest in 10 months. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The Simpsons need no introduction, but back in 1989, when I interviewed their creator, cartoonist Matt Groening, Bart Simpson hadn't yet become a household word. The animated cartoon had appeared from time to time on the Tracy Ullman Show, and the family was just about to have its own Christmas special as a preview of a weekly primetime series on Fox. We decided to feature this interview as part of our holiday series from the Fresh Air Archives. I spoke with Matt Groening in December of 1989, when he wasn't at all sure The Simpsons would catch on. I asked him if he would describe The Simpsons as an animated sitcom.
They're more like a hallucination of a sitcom, for me. Anyway, I'm so used to drawing my cartoons and not having them move that when I see these characters actually come to life and strangle each other and shout and yell and laugh and scream, it's like hallucinating, at least for me. And I hope that that experience will be the same for the rest of America.
For our listeners who aren't familiar with The Simpsons yet, describe the family for us.
It's a family of five. There's Homer Simpson, the father.
Ah, son, one day you're going to know the satisfaction of payday, receiving a big fat check for a job well done.
He works in a nuclear power plant. He's a technical supervisor. What that means is a little conveyor belt goes by and he flicks off rocks that aren't glowing. We're trying to endear ourselves to the nuclear power industry with this one. And his wife, Marge, who spends her time trying to keep Homer from strangling the kids.
All right, children, let me have those letters. I'll send them to Santa's workshop at the North Pole.
Oh, please. There's only one fat guy that brings us presents, and his name ain't Santa.
Then there's Bart, an anagram for brat. He's the sort of the center character of the series. He's sort of based on that, you know, that Diane Arbus photo of the little kid in Central Park, you know, grimacing and clutching a little toy gun in shorts. It's sort of based on him. But this woman, Nancy Cartwright, who plays the voice of Bart, made him into more of a hipster. He started saying, hey, man, and he just became more groovy, more beatnik-like.
Let's get this show on the road, man. We got things to do.
And then he's got a younger sister, Lisa, who's 8 years old and plays the baritone saxophone, can define words that the rest of the family is mystified by. Is generally sensitive, intelligent, gifted, and as a result, completely ignored and misunderstood by the rest of her family.
Aside from the fact that he has the same frailties as all human beings, he's the only father I have. Therefore, he is my model of manhood, and my estimation of him will govern the prospects of my adult relationships.
And then the baby of the family is Maggie, who communicates strictly by sucking on her pacifier in varying rhythms, something like this.
That sounds a lot like it.
Yep.
Well, I remember the first interview we did. You were talking about how you thought of yourself as someone who really couldn't draw very well.
Right.
So now you're drawing your characters for animation, and there's other people helping to animate them, right? Because there's too much to draw every week. So you have all these probably like really talented artists who really know how to draw, and they're drawing your characters?
Well, it's been a real strange experience telling 50 men and women, all of whom can draw very well, to to make their drawings crummier in order to look like my stuff. It's kind of exhilarating, although, you know, when you walk away and you hear them muttering, you know, you can feel taken aback. And their caricatures of me at the animation studio are downright vicious.
So now that you have all these talented artists drawing your characters, do you ever worry that something of the edge will be lost in the characters because there's a smoothness that they could bring to the drawings?
Yeah, it's been a real struggle to keep a certain
roughness.
Yeah, roughness and abruptness and jerkiness. Working on this show are animators from Hanna-Barbera and Disney and great virtuoso independent projects, and they all bring their own attitude and aesthetic philosophy to the project, and it's been a real struggle to make sure that everybody gets in line and has the same vision and is at least looking in the same direction. As an example, almost every animator today worships Tex Avery.
Tex Avery is one of the Looney Tunes guys.
One of the Looney Tunes guys that did, you know, he's the guy that had eyeballs popping out of wolves' heads and their tongues falling to the floor and very exaggerated, very violent, really jazzy stuff, brilliant stuff. And that's not what we're trying to do in The Simpsons. With our cartoon effects are not beep, boing, chonk, you know, and all those kind of crazy effects that you've got imprinted on your brain. They're more realistic, and it's a slightly different kind of humor, and it takes a while to get the hang of.
Did you have to draw? I don't know if it's called a Bible or not, but did you have to draw what each of your characters look like from different angles and in motion, so that the animators would know how the characters look?
Yes, Mike's stuff is basically. I see it two-dimensionally. It's very flat, and I draw my characters almost always from a three-quarter profile. And the animators had to come up with ways of showing them from straight on and from behind. Those are angles that I rarely, if ever, use in my own work. But even tougher than that was we created a 8-inch-high Bart head in clay for the Bart Simpson talking doll, which is due in your local toy stores if the show is a hit. And I'm really proud of this doll because he gets to say a number of outrageous things. The only thing the toy company wouldn't let me have him say is, I'm Bart Simpson, who the hell are you? They felt that was too much to come out of a kid's toy. They also wouldn't let him burp, which I was very disappointed by. But
so what,
maybe that in the next time.
What does he say?
My favorite thing is, kids in TV land, you're being duped. I had a lot of flack over that because they said kids aren't going to know what the word duped means. So I offered the substitute brainwashed, but they didn't go for that.
Your character, Bart, and as you pointed out, it's an acronym for brat.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what kinds of things you pulled when you were a kid that drove your parents crazy.
Got in trouble an awful lot in school as I was growing up. I had a strong sense of injustice, and if I felt I was being treated unfairly, I let those around me know it. I may make light of the fact that I did stuff that got me in trouble, but I got in trouble for doing stuff that I should be rewarded for. I mean, I got in trouble for making comics. I got in trouble for putting on little plays and stuff. All this creative stuff was completely squelched and ignored. I got mad one time and I dropped an encyclopedia out the window. Okay, so you know, it's that kind of thing.
Didn't land on anybody, did it?
No, it didn't. But they could have, and that's why I had to write the 1,000-word essay on why not to throw encyclopedias. In fact, I seem to have I probably have in my files a whole sheaf of essays. I have why not to drop encyclopedias out the window? Why I must remain quiet in class? And my favorite was, why I must not throw rotten apples, because I did throw a rotten apple into the air, and it landed on a kid's head, and I got in trouble for it. So I had to write why not to throw rotten apples, and I got in further trouble for my essay because it was a single sentence, in which I just said, well, you shouldn't throw a rotten apple because it might fly across the street and break the window of a grocery store, and the shards of glass might cut someone, and then the person might stagger out into the street, get hit by a car, which, trying to veer out of the way, runs over a neighborhood dog who gets taken to the hospital, and, you know, and on and on and on.
A lot of your cartoons seem to draw on childhood experiences or childhood feelings that you had. Do you think your memories of childhood are any more vivid than your average person's memories of childhood?
I think that if people think hard, they can recall the same kind of stuff I did. But I got to say, one difference between most people and me is, at the time, I had a feeling that something was terribly wrong, and so I took notes. I kept diaries when I was a kid, so I have a huge backlog of evidence to back me up in my ideas about kids' life. Also, a lot of humor about children is based on the idea that kids' traumas are cute and trivial and inconsequential. And, you know, the fact is, for kids, many of those little inconsequential traumas are not so inconsequential. They're actually great big deals, and they have no way of standing back from the conflicts in their lives. And in my stuff, I try to take those traumas and deal with them on their level.
You are a father now.
Yep.
Your baby will be 1 year old in March, I believe?
Yep.
So are you starting to see things now more from the parent's perspective than the kid perspective?
I've really painted myself into a corner. I've done all this stuff that, positively takes the side of the kid, and now I'm on the other side. I'm a dad, but I'm not going to draw comics about my kid. I'm tempted to, and people keep on saying, "Oh, we expect parenthood as hell." I don't think I want to give him any ammunition for his therapy 20 years from now.
For a Daddy Dearest book,
right? But it's going to be fun. It is fun.
Matt Groening is the creator of The Simpsons. Our interview was recorded in 1989. More from the archives after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Tomorrow night, CBS will broadcast the film Who Framed Roger Rabbit. So we figured this was a good time to feature an excerpt of our interview with the film's star, Bob Hoskins. Hoskins also starred in Mona Lisa, The Long Good Friday, The Cotton Club, Mermaids, and Hook. In our 1989 interview, he told me he became an actor nearly by accident.
I was in a bow in an amateur theater, and there was a lot of people there sort of reading these, well, at the time, were scripts. I didn't know what a script was. And this guy came down and said, "Right, you're next." And I, "Oh, am I?" And I'd had enough drink to sort of think, "Oh, okay, feel a bit adventurous." Went upstairs, and they said, "Have you seen the script?" I said, "No, what does it look like?" And they gave me the script, said, "Do you want to read it?" And I read it, and they said, "Well, do you want to read it out loud so we can hear it?" So I read it out loud. And I got the part. I was playing the lead in this play. And the first night, an agent came to see it and said, "You should take this up professionally." I said, well, get us a job and I will. And she did. And I've been a professional actor ever since.
Was your Cockney accent ever a problem in roles you had to play?
Not really, no.
Did you have to learn different accents when you started acting? Did you already know how to do that?
Well, I suppose if a guy... I've always told jokes, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to tell jokes, there's always racial jokes. And I used to tell all kinds of racial jokes, you know?
So,
all
yeah.
kinds of different accents.
So you have to do accents to tell the jokes?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, gosh. I know you performed, I think, pretty early in your career in a play with John Gielgud?
Yeah.
Did you learn anything from him?
Yes, I did. Well, he was extraordinary, Gielgud. Because I had only been in the business, 2-3 years. And suddenly I was on stage in a 40-minute scene with John Gielgud, and I had all the lines. I couldn't believe it. And he was wonderful. He was really wonderful to work with. I never forget, I had a line in the scene. What was it? I can't remember what the line was now, but it was a funny line. It was a gag line.
Uh-huh.
And, but I it wasn't getting as much as I thought it should get, you know?
As much laughter?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And I said to him, you know, what am I... I said, I'm not getting enough out of this. He said, well, what you should do, he said, is when you come to the line, step back 2 paces, count 2, and then say it. What? You've got to be kidding. Said, no, it'll be fine, I promise you. And so he came to me. I'd forgotten about this, and he was sitting up on this big box all the way through the scene. And I came to the line, and he shouted out down to me, step back 2 paces and count 2. So, oh, you've killed it. Thanks a lot. So I did. I stepped back 2 paces, counted 2, and the audience went crazy. I got around. And I looked up at him, and he's not very good at winking, and there he is trying to wink at me. You know, I told you so. Well, after that, I did it again the night afterwards, and I got another round. I thought, he must be doing something up there. What's he doing? This can't be me. So the night after, I did it again. And quick, as soon as I said it, I whipped round and looked at him again. And he was still sitting there trying to wink at me. You know, he wasn't doing a thing. And every night after that, I stepped back 2 paces, counted 2, and got a round. And I could never figure this out. And ever since, every single show I've ever done, there's always a point where I'll step back 2 paces, count 2, and I've never got a thing, not a titter. It's never worked since.
So that's not something that has changed your career forever from
no,
this
no,
little
no,
lesson.
No, it's driving me nuts.
Do you think it was really like making faces at the audience or doing something behind your back?
Well, I thought he was, and I thought I'd catch him out, but he wasn't, no.
That's funny. Thanks so much for talking with us. I've really enjoyed hearing from you immensely. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Bob Hoskins from a 1989 interview. This is Fresh Air.
I'm Linda Wertheimer. Later on All Things Considered, we'll take a look at the issue of sending thousands of troops into Somalia to protect aid supplies there and ask a relief worker whether it makes sense to them. We'll talk to a man who is volunteering to go into the area where the fighting is going on in Bosnia as a volunteer to help refugees. There is theoretically an improvement in consumer confidence in this country. We'll hear about that and talk to some of the people we've met during the course of the year and ask them how their confidence is and what they've got on their Christmas list as a result. And we will talk about Santa Fe, the new Mecca for the new age. That's later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
A few weeks ago, singer Vernell Bonnerice and pianist Morten Gunnar Larsen came to the Fresh Air studio for a concert of Jelly Roll Morten songs. Bonnerice and Larsen are currently performing a Morten review at Michael's Pub in New York. Well, we recorded more good material than we had time for, so here's an excerpt of the concert that our listeners haven't heard yet. There's a song that you do in your review, Dr. Jazz, which Jelly Roll Morten didn't write, but he's very associated with.
Right. He says in the review, he said, that number there I did not write, but I'm the one made it famous. So he does it for them.
Would you do it for us?
Yes, I would. Everybody gets the blues now and then and don't know what to do. I've had it happen many, many times to me. So have you. But those days have gone and passed. I found out what to do at last. When I feel all in, down and out, you will hear me shout. Life troubles bound and mixed. Here's the fella that can get you fixed. Hello Central, give me Dr. Jazz. Shoes, Lord, more I get, the more I want, it seems. I'm just chasing old Dr. Jazz in my dreams. Life troubles may be bound and mixed. Here's the fella that can get you fixed. Hello, Central, give me Dr. Jazz.
Vernell Bonnerice and Morten Gunnar Larsen, they're performing their Jelly Roll Morton review at Michael's Pub in New York. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a firsthand account of what it's like to be autistic. Donna Williams is an autistic woman who is also remarkably articulate. She's written an autobiography about living in what she calls a world under glass. Also, we talk with Dr. Richard Rimland, a psychologist who specializes in autism. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.